What's up, everyone? I'm Andrew Steinwald, and this is Zima Red. On this show, we speak with the users, founders, and creatives that are diving into the world of unique digital assets, also called non-fungible tokens.
Andrew Steinwald is the managing partner of Sifirmion, an investment firm focused on the NFT ecosystem. All opinions expressed by Andrew and podcast guests are solely their own opinions and do not reflect the opinion of Sifirmion. This podcast is for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as a basis for investment decisions. Sifirmion or related entities may maintain positions in the assets discussed in this podcast.
My guest today is Kevin Beauregard. Kevin is the founder of Atmos, which is an upcoming game universe that combines sports, lore, and crypto economics to create an engaging and competitive virtual experience. On this episode, we chat being a crypto founder in 2013, attempting to build a fantasy NFT basketball game in 2019, sports as the ultimate Trojan horse to crypto mass adoption, balancing skill-based gameplay with crypto economics, creating a competitive game combined with a virtual world, Atmos' initial core game loops of mining, fabricating, and racing, and so much more. I had a blast on this one, so I hope you enjoy my conversation with Kevin. Kevin, thank you so much for joining me today. Super excited to chat with you. And to get us started, I'd love to hear a little bit about your background.
Likewise, totally stoked to be here. I'm a bit of a crypto boomer at this point. I think I got into the space in 2013. I had a really interesting sort of what's the right word there? Jumping off moment, or diving deep into the ecosystem moment, when a buddy of mine who worked on Wall Street at the time called me in the middle of Bitcoin's first run up in 2013 and said, how can I short Bitcoin? And I read the white paper, called them back 24 hours later and said, you can do whatever the hell you want, but I just bought some. And the rest is kind of history. But my background has largely been as a software engineer, as an entrepreneur. I briefly played minor league hockey before I did all that. Before realizing that I probably shouldn't get hit in the head anymore and I should try to use my engineering degree for something.
That's amazing. Awesome. Okay, so I believe that you started or were involved in a project called GoCoin. Could you tell me more about that?
Sure. We were super early to the payment space. And so I was the tech guy, technical co-founder there. And really, we set out to create a payment processor that was multi-coin from the start. So rather than looking at the world as Bitcoin only or as a Bitcoin maximalist, we said we believe that there's going to be lots of these things and we should try to create payment rails for all of them. And so GoCoin was the first payment processor accepting Litecoin. We were accepting Dogecoin back in 2014, like right when it came out, and there was almost no liquidity. And it's terrifying to think about the Dogecoin that we flipped to cash and is no longer with us as a result. But it was a phenomenal learning experience on a number of fronts. But the payments business is brutal.
That's awesome. And that was in what, 2013, 14?
Or yeah, we started that in summer of 2013. We were live by the fall, right as Bitcoin was starting to make that first run up to 1,000. And then I still remember that I was on the stage at Launch Festival the day that Mt. Gox collapsed. and then we rode out, at least that was my first crypto winter.
That's so cool. Wait, so yeah, really, really briefly, like, tell me about the collapse of Mt. Gox in the sense of, like, what did it do to the enthusiasm? Was everyone just super bearish, or like what was the situation?
In retrospect, it feels like it got bearish overnight. I think realistically, it probably took a little bit longer. We now know, right, that Bitcoin has been on this 4-year cycle. And so even given the run up in the fall and everything else that happened, with it passing 1,000, like, Bitcoin was due for a correction just because of how much it had run up. But Mt. Gox really exacerbated that. And there was so little trust in the space at a, macro level at the time, that an event like that really sucked all the air out of the room, right? Here you had, these conferences that were going off touting Bitcoin and everything else at that point in time. And as, the second coming, right? And And then that happens, and overnight, all the trust is gone. What little trust there was, anyways, was gone. And so, you know, it was kind of like one of those, like, okay, like, how deeply do we believe in this, kind of gut check moments? And I think everybody across the space at the time felt that. I think ultimately, and we'll touch on this, I'm sure, later, but one of the things that you know, the crypto community at large has is quite a bit of resiliency. And I think that ends up showing through as we get into, you know, get through that sort of crypto winter 2014, 2015, and you start to see things turn around. But that was certainly a very trying moment. And I will be honest and say, like, my faith in the ecosystem was certainly tested, as like, you know, you start to feel that lament of the markets not turning around and doing what they were doing in 2013.
I mean, yeah, going off that, like, I sold all my Bitcoin in 2014. I was like, Bitcoin's right. Dead. It's over. Blockchain. I became a big blockchain, not Bitcoin believer.
That was totally the mantra.
Exactly. I was such a lemming. I was like, okay, blockchain's the real deal. Bitcoin's dead. Like, what's next? And then when Ripple came out in 2014, I was like in love with Ripple. Anyways, that's a whole other journey. But all right, so after GoCoin, I think you started a company or were involved in a company called Valor Prime. What was that?
No. So, so that was actually just kind of taking a step back there for 1 second. You know, when I said I had my faith tested, I ended up leaving the blockchain space. Similar to you, I was using Bitcoin to pay rent in 2014, right? Like, which massive regret, right? But you know, I think at the end of the day, like, you know, you do what you have to do. But so I you know, said to myself, you know what, you know, I need a break, and I kind of hit that full burnout point. And I ended up leaving the industry for, you know, a minute. And I actually jumped around between a couple different startups. And I ended up at Hulu for a little while before ultimately I got it. You know, I really said to myself, you know what, I really miss the blockchain community. And I had stayed involved, and I had been involved in Ethereum mining as, you know, that blockchain took off. And it stayed involved as a developer on my own time, and ultimately said, you know what, I want to go and build more infrastructure in this space, and decided to start my second venture in the space, which was called Aux Labs in 2017.
That's so cool. Okay, so tell me, what is Aux Labs?
So we set out to build DeFi infrastructure. And specifically at that time, right, it was ICO mania. And so we set out to build auction tech, specifically as price discovery tools for ICOs. And we really quickly realized that that was a mistake, because it turns out, A, people really didn't want price discovery at all in ICOs. They wanted to watch things go to the moon, which meant that we had designed a product without an actual product market fit. But also that it really was less of a standalone product than it was a feature, right? And we've seen that in the last, call it 4 or 5 years, where you've seen a lot of platforms build auction tech into them as opposed to a standalone platform or trying to create a decentralized auction platform. right, Sushi Miso as an example of that, right? But yeah, so we ended up, you know, seeing the launch of CryptoKitties in the fall of 2017 and going, okay, we think NFTs are going to be a thing. Let's take all this auction tech and go and build an NFT marketplace, which was awesome. We were a little bit too early on that front, and, you know, OpenSea kind of already had an edge. So we were both too early and too late in the same breath, right? We did build and launch an NFT marketplace by June of 2018. And then we said, okay, there aren't quite enough NFT projects to make this a viable business. And that was my jumping point into the world of blockchain gaming, and ultimately into building NFT projects.
That's so cool. Okay, wait, so you did spend some time at The Block. I'd love to hear about that experience there.
Awesome. So at Block, I was one of the lead engineers on Vesper Finance. So Vesper is a DeFi yield aggregator. We were building strategies that, you know, were going and looking at, you know, multiple protocols and aggregating those yields for users. So trying to make DeFi as simple as possible for users, ultimately with a heavy focus on user experience and returning the most attractive yield in the most safe and secure way.
That's awesome. Okay, so you have DeFi experience, you have building experience, you have experience from payments to NFT marketplaces, and kind of it ranges the whole kind of crypto ecosystem. And then at what point were you like, all right, you know, this is all great, but I really want to combine all of these skill sets and this knowledge base that I've been, you know, building up for the past couple of years and launch my own project. Tell me about like the formation of what you're doing now and how that came to be.
Absolutely. So I've been really enamored for a long time with this idea of marrying sports and blockchain together, right? And there are lots of people that have been enamored with that idea. I think it's natural, right? We look at sports as this great fandom opportunity. I had the opportunity to at one point get paid to play a sport. But I really wanted to put those two ideas together. And the more that I thought about how do I put those two ideas together, the more that the current ecosystem, sports landscape ecosystem, looked like just a massive barrier to entry. And I kept coming back to this idea of like, well, if you want to marry sports and blockchain, you basically have to create a sport, right? And in the same breath, I was looking at and at Ox in back in 2018 and 2019, we attempted to build a early version of a fantasy basketball game using NFTs. And as we were building that, to be a little bit contrarian, I started writing an essay about why we shouldn't be building it. And the more that I wrote that essay, I also started to convince myself that I might be right, which is that if you're building a game that is ultimately going to live in the metaverse, or maybe to rephrase that question, right? If I'm in Decentraland, right, and I'm sitting courtside at a Lakers game, what am I watching? Where am I really? And who's playing? Because it's not the Lakers and it's not basketball. And because at the end of the day, if you're in a metaverse, then whatever you're doing should feel metaverse native. It shouldn't be limited by what a human being can do. And the more that I kind of thought about that thesis and I looked at like these things in fiction that have such amazing grasps of, you know, our attention, right? Like, I know, as an example, right? I love calling out Quidditch in Harry Potter as this kind of fantastical game. It's a terrible sport if you think about the rules and how it's written and to be played, but it's fantastic because you're flying around at a million miles an hour on broomsticks. And I think about Ender's Game, and I think about, you know, the battle room and that idea of playing this game in zero gravity. And it absolutely captured my imagination. And I kept coming back to that idea of how do I build that in a way that is, or that is metaverse native, right? And so I started to champion this idea of metaverse native sports, or creating games that look and feel like what we understand as sports in the real physical world, but that are, you know, obviously virtual, and aren't what we're seeing in the esports arenas right now, right? Tangentially, right, I think that part of the challenge to mainstream adoption for esports is that they're such a cognitive leap for people that you really have to understand the rules and take the time to understand each of those games to grasp that it's, you know, or grasp how to be a fan. Whereas, you know, things that we consider sports or things that we look at like sports today, racing, right? Formula One, MotoGP, those are really easy to understand. Anything with racing, you're looking to see who wins. Like, yes, there's all kinds of nuance to those things, but it's easy to grasp and pick up and watch. And that idea of spectatorship, especially as we start talking about metaverses and how this space evolves, is one that really grabbed and drew my attention. And so ultimately what we're building now, it's called Atmos, And it is a world that's designed for metaverse native sports. And everything that we've done in creating that world is designed to facilitate that.
That's so cool. Okay, so I really love what you said about kind of the current ecosystem of esports and that viewership, because yeah, I mean, like, I'm not a League of Legends player, so when I'm seeing League of Legends on YouTube or like wherever on Twitch or whatnot, I'm confused. I'm like, I don't even know what's going on. I don't know who's winning. And because like as you said, you have to really be in the weeds within that, you know, economy or ecosystem or game to understand what's going on. But I like how you said it, racing, people can right away be like, oh, I get it. Like, you have to cross the finish line, the first one there wins and whatnot. So with these games that you're designing, is there one that you're focusing on first in terms of creating this metaverse native sports or sport? And then going forward, as you see Atmos evolving, are you looking at, okay, well, what other sports can we take inspiration from that don't cause people to have that cognitive, you know, kind of confusion there in terms of like what's actually happening within this game?
Absolutely. So as a backdrop, and you know, just to you know, put a little bit more clarity on the table, right? The world that we design is exosuit based. So as your core game piece or component, you have to have a exo. And so the first game that we're launching is a racing game for all the reasons that I just said. And it's racing in three dimensions. It's racing in an exosuit. And you know, we're designing that to be entirely skill based and extremely competitive. Right. And so that's our first one. And really everything that we're doing ties together story plus economy plus that competitive nature. And so from a story standpoint, the approach we're taking is that Atmos is the name of the planet that we're on, and it's set about 500 years in the future. And this mining colony has started to use these suits that were developed for mining in space to race competitively. And that storyline enables us to add and grow as these games evolve.
That's super cool. Okay, so you I think you said three components. I think it was the sport, the story slash lore, we'll call it, and then the economy. Are those like the three major components of Atmos?
Absolutely. I mean, I think story above all is necessary for a world to exist, right? And we wanted to take that approach of world building, and really to not only justify how we're doing what we're doing, but also when we think about, you know, this idea of an open decentralized metaverse, right? I think of it as lots of worlds coming together and building things that are interoperable and eventually, you know, converge, and there's ways to kind of jump between them. And maybe I'm getting a little bit ahead of myself. But I felt like it was really important for us to build Atmos as a world, and have a really concrete rule set for how things work and why they work the way that they do, so that we could build these games and have them be as fun and as competitive as we wanted them to.
No, I mean, that makes total sense to me, because it's like, I can't even fathom Quidditch without Harry Potter. Like, if it was just Quidditch, I'd be like, what's going on here? If you made Harry Potter and then Quidditch, I'm like, okay, I totally get, yep, like kind of this whole
exactly
connection. So how are you going to communicate this lore and story of the Atmos world to everyone, like in terms of, yeah, just like, how are you going to communicate that? And also, you keep mentioning like a world, whether will there be like an actual like planet that, you know, the users can go to and like hang out on and do stuff on?
Absolutely. To answer your second question first, absolutely. But as far as story, we're taking an entirely transmediated approach to world building. So we're releasing media that is, you know, separate from gameplay alongside gameplay. And so ultimately, the first thing we're doing is an 8-issue comic series that'll be coming out starting over the summer. And then they'll be coming out, issues will be coming out every 2 months, roughly, after the first issue does. And that will all start to create the stage for what we like to think of as emergent storytelling, right? Wherein, you know, after those first issues start coming out and as gameplay is live, right now, things that users do in game and in world will ultimately start to impact the storyline in the comics, right? Now, if you win a tournament, right? Well, maybe that's the subject of issue 7, right? And so we start to break the fourth wall sort of in reverse, or maybe that's the wrong expression, but start to basically allow the users to tell the story or to impact the story.
That's so cool. It reminds me kind of that Netflix series. I forget what it was, but like it was some weird German word or name, but basically you could choose. Like it would be like you're the son and you could like, right. I forget, it was like beat up your dad or like say thank you to your dad. And then like the viewer would have to actually choose a story. Mm-hmm. And then the actual remaining part of the show would be different dependent on your choices. I thought that was like something really, really interesting. First time I've experienced or like watched something like that. So to have, that was like a static experience where me as a viewer, I'm choosing two options and then I'm affecting the story. That was cool. But with this, it's like added benefit in the sense of not only do I feel a sense of ownership because I probably own some exosuits and kind of, you know, I'm involved in that sense, but also the fact that I can alter this whole storyline of this universe potentially by winning or losing or whatever.
Well, and that's really cool. And that your character, right, that you're the pilot that you are interacting with this world as, right, is ultimately immortalized. Right. Not only did you win a particular competition or you're climbing the ranks and you're, elite from a competitive sense, but you're also gaining fandom. Right. I think that the spectacle component of gaming has become huge, obviously, in the last, 5-6 years with Twitch specifically. But in the case of blockchain gaming, we have this incredible opportunity to immortalize characters, right? And so as we tell these stories, and as you're, impacting the story just by participating, ultimately, right, that's a sort of chance at blockchain immortality.
That's so cool. Yeah, and it's really cool you bring that up because I feel like not many people are focused on fandom/spectatorship in terms of their games necessarily. And if you think about like why is Lewis Hamilton, why are they so popular? And you could argue, it's number one, because they're really good at what they do. That's kind of obvious. But number two, it's kind of like the money involved. I think that the amounts of money involved in their skill, because you could be like, the top badminton player in the world and just dominate badminton. But like the money's not as important there. And so people, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think people care as much. And with blockchain and NFTs and like where we're headed, I think that there's going to be some real money on the line in the future. And so we could have, the Lewis Hamiltons or like the Ronaldos of these Web3 gaming sports, which I think is kind of goes into what you're talking about with this fandom and spectatorship, which is super, super interesting.
Absolutely. I mean, I think, and it's funny, but at lower tiers of competition in anything, right? Like as an example, playing sports as a kid, right? You want a cool, I played hockey. So, right. Like you want the cool stick that everybody has. You want the best pair of skates. But the reality is as a 10-year-old, you can't make use of the best skates. It doesn't matter what you have strapped onto your feet. Like you're learning to play a game, right? You're not anywhere close to a professional tier. But as you climb up the pyramid and as you get more and more competitive with things, like that nuance, the type of gear and the way that you use equipment matters, right? And right, there's a reason why people who compete at the top of any sport are sponsored the way that they're sponsored, right? It not only is it important for the brand, but also like athletes at that level are using the best equipment because to them that nuance matters. And so, this, the same is true for gaming and for Web3 gaming, right? We want things to be competitive and we want, there to be fairness, but at the end of the day, right, the best players and the most competitive should also have access to the best gear. And when we think about sports economies as a whole, that's a big part of it, right? It's how do you facilitate that, and ultimately enable that to happen somewhat organically.
Very cool. Okay, so I want to talk more about like the game loops or like kind of what do I as a player, what can I do in the Atmos universe? And I'd love to kind of explore that realm.
Absolutely. So you asked previously, and I realize that now that I didn't answer one of your previous questions, which was, will there be a world eventually that I can explore? And I just said yes and moved on. But ultimately, the answer there is yes, eventually, right? And I say that to sort of, make the point that we absolutely want this to be an open world in which you can interact with every part of it, but also the knowing that that's an incredibly hard thing to build. And when you build for everyone, you end up building for no one. And so our focus out of the gate is to deliver these competitive titles within an open world ecosystem and then layer in those additional interactivity and additional utility for things over time. And so, our core three loops, right, are mining, fabricating, and racing out of the gate. And racing is sort of synonymous with competing, and we'll layer in additional competitive layers over time. But those mining and fabrication loops are very crypto native. Right. Mining is core to our economy. And I love that word just because it's obviously used so pervasively throughout the blockchain and crypto ecosystems. But ultimately, right, that is our resourcing system. And interacting with that is, much more like DeFi than it is like resource gathering in a traditional game. Our fabrication system is a little bit of a blend, right? It's very similar to a exceptionally deep crafting system, but it's using those resource components from that mining system to create new NFTs. So we have a system in which you are literally burning fungible resource tokens and crafting new NFTs, which are ultimately usable in game and in world. And that crafting system is incredibly deep. And so those two components are ultimately completely separate from that competitive loop. I do not need to participate in those sort of completely crypto native portions if I don't want to. I can just have an exosuit and I can compete in the racing loop. However, if I want to participate in those, then I can, ostensibly participate in all three and, not only leverage all of the economics that Atmos has to offer or all of the crafting and creativity that it has to offer, but ultimately like layer all of that into how I'm competing.
That's so cool. Okay. So let's go with mining first. So if I want to just mine stuff, cause I'm not really a big racer, what is that process like? Do I go, like, is like a 2D, is like a DeFi protocol where I'm just like clicking some buttons and it's automatic, or am I going into like the asteroids or something and like finding resources? Like, what is this experience like for mining?
Out of the gate, it'll be much more like DeFi than it will be like going into asteroids and mining. And that's intentional, right? We want to keep it simple and utilitarian at first. Like I said, it is a economic underpinning. And so it really is much more like yield farming with a new set of rules than any other comparable that I could make to it. However, the number of assets that are mineable and the choices that you have to make are material, right? You have to decide whether you want carbon or gold or aluminum. and what you can use those things for will ultimately be, shown over time, will require a little bit of experimentation as well.
That's really cool. Okay, so now into the fabricating loop. I have these resources, and now my objective is to turn them into the fastest suits, or what am I trying to optimize for on the fabricating portion?
You tell me. What are you trying to optimize for? I mean, it could be appearance, right? It could be rarity. Or it could be performance, and all of those things matter. And ultimately, I think it probably makes sense to digress a little bit and talk about the exosuit as a whole. We're treating these like wearable vehicles, right? Ultimately, it is at least, and I say at least because we are adding a few more modifiable components, but it is at least 31 unique parts that you can swap in and out and change. A good portion of our design team on these has worked in the automobile industry. And so we're very cognizant about part lines and creating these things in a way where all of the pieces are swappable with each other, and ultimately you can compose the suit that you want, right? So if you don't want to, and you just want to use the stock thing off the shelf and not change anything and just, again, play the competitive part of the game, then you can. But you're missing out on that customization component and sort of that tuner culture that the auto industry has had, where you can customize basically everything that you want about this. And those components have not only material impact, right? As an example, right? Carbon fiber is lighter than steel, right? And so thinking about, you know, not only what types of materials you want to use to create certain components, but also the performance impact of those things. Similarly, right, there's also how it looks in the finished product and how we let you, you know, color certain things, because material, you know, using certain materials will enable you to have, you know, certain color outputs, et cetera. But like I said, these are wearable vehicles. And so ultimately, right, we want the users to be able to have a significant degree of customizability, such that, again, when you're competing in whatever tier you're competing in, you're showing off, right? Like, that is the flex. It's like, look at what I have. And part of what we're doing there is, you know, we're letting people use their other NFTs as decals on the suits, right? And so, you know, in my mind, there's not much cooler than, you know, beating somebody in a race and showing off a clone as I'm doing it, right? Because that's part of my digital identity, and therefore, right, why shouldn't I be able to show it off?
That's super cool. So I can put my CryptoPunks on my suit, so people, you know, I can kind of flex in that sense and show, hey, I have some CryptoPunks, I'm pretty cool.
Exactly. Why not? Right. I mean, that's awesome. Ricky Bobby did it. He put a Panther on a Wonder Bread car, right?
I love that. Yeah. Okay. So you mentioned that the actual game itself is 100% skill-based. Like, why do you decide to do that? And also, how can you do that if people are building these suits, which in essence can like optimize performance?
So optimizing performance is not the same as guaranteeing a win, right? you know, we're very, very cognizant of avoiding pay to win to the extent possible, right? Some of that is in how to set up competitive brackets, right? And not allowing certain types of gear into certain tiers of races, right? Separately, right, you're not going to catch Lewis Hamilton driving a Honda Civic, right? And if he was driving a Honda Civic, he'd still probably be faster than most of us driving any other car that you put us in. And the reality is, at some point, right, skill separates and skill should give you access to better and more capable gear. It doesn't necessarily mean that you know how to use it. But also optimizing for a certain gameplay style, right? Remember, these are suits that fly. Ultimately, you know, just because you have the fastest suit doesn't mean you have the best way through a particular race course. And so we're very cognizant of that and balancing for it, ultimately recognizing that we don't want there to be an experience for people where they feel like they're getting smoked just because somebody has better gear. I think, you know, we're cognizant of it and are avoiding it in the sense that we're forbidding, you know, and also keeping, you know, player ratings will also preclude people's ability to compete at certain levels.
That makes sense. It's kind of like, I guess, like Need for Speed, which is a car racing game where, you know, you can increase your car's acceleration, but then like the top speed goes down, and or you increase the top speed and the handling goes down, or like the handling goes up. And then so it's kind of like you can increase for certain parameters, but you can't just do like across the board the most powerful thing ever.
And some of it, and some of it is customizing for your play style, right? Like you might like, you know, optimizing for a certain dynamic, right? One great example there is Call of Duty, because at the end of the day, you could play Call of Duty with any loadout basically and be, you know, reasonably competitive and have a good time, because they're well balanced. They all have very different statistics, but they're well balanced.
Totally. Okay. Understood. All right. So I have to ask, I mean, do I get anything for winning if I'm dominating these races? Do I get win like, I don't know. Do I get Ethereum? Do I win like NFTs? Like, what do I get?
So yes, and it'll depend on the race and the tier, obviously. But that's part of the, you know, the whole philosophy of play and earn, right? Is making sure there is that ability for users to earn and participate in a complete economy as a result of that. And so we have our native token EQD that will be sort of the core transactional component of our economy, but also keeping in mind that some race prizing might be in resource tokens, right? It might be in those ores that you can mine. But in general, yes, absolutely. We want to be highly competitive, and we also want to make sure that, yeah, if you're winning stuff, you're winning stuff.
That's awesome. Okay. So let's say that I'm really focused on just the mining and fabricating portion of Atmos, and I don't actually like to race for whatever reason. Can I bet on other people that do race?
Not right now.
I assume there's gotta be some sort of laws that are.
I look at derivative gameplay as a mark of success. So we are absolutely planning for it. But we do not want to say out of the gate, like, yes, we're just going to have, you know, those derivative markets available. We don't want that, because at the end of the day, we also need to make sure that we are balanced and that gameplay is as tight and as competitive as it can be. And then as we're hitting, you know, scale, then yeah, there absolutely should be derivative components. And whether we build them or somebody else does, right? Remember, open decentralized metaverse, if somebody wants to build that, then more power to them. Then yeah, we would love to see that evolve.
That's really cool. So like, does that, if you go down that path, do you need like a gambling license? Like, is it a whole thing, or is it still kind of on because it's a video game, the rules are less, you know, strict, or like, I don't know if you've done research on that, but I'd love to know.
I'm going to leave that one to the lawyers.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. All right. So I want to talk, and we've touched upon this multiple times, but I'd love to learn more just about like the economy. You mentioned that, okay, on the base you have ores, then I guess, will you pay people to fabricate? So if I'm like really good at fabricating gold, but not good at fabricating aluminum, like how does that work? And do I get compensated for that? And then you mentioned the rate, when you race, you actually can win and you know, win rewards. So just broadly, would love to learn about the economy.
Absolutely. So, I mean, again, at that base, right, we've got somewhere between 20 and 30, fungible resources that exist, and we'll add more over time. But those can be combined into various composites that ultimately end up in or on your suit. how that fabrication process, you can do it yourself, or yes, you could have somebody else with a higher skill do it for you, in which case you would likely pay them. And there will be a marketplace facilitating that. But that higher skill increases the chance of the desired output, right? and you know, one piece we haven't touched on here is land ownership within Atmos, which is obviously planned, in which case you have the ability not only to, you know, mine your own land, right? You could also mine land that belongs to a collective, or you could mine land that belongs to somebody else. And ultimately, you would, obviously, there are economic components to that specifically, and those transactions and how they take place.
That's super cool. So that's really interesting. I'm trying to think about the actual emissions of, so the emissions of raw, you know, materials or resources, whatever you want to call them, these fungible resources, it's going to be variable, right? Because like, I'm not going to get 10 gold every time I go to this plot, or else that'd be too easy.
So not only is it variable, but it, not every plot has the same distribution, right? You don't necessarily know what a given plot has or how a particular vein of ore exists. And maybe it spans three adjacent plots, but it's not in the fourth, right? And you also, there's also choice involved, right? I can't choose to mine for everything that a plot has at once. I have to choose and say, I want to mine for these couple things, right? I have to say, I'm specifically looking for gold, or I'm specifically looking for platinum or I'm looking for something more common like iron or carbon or silicon, right? And really we took a I'm not going to say, real world approach to how we look at those ore bases, right? But we definitely pulled from real world, and I'll call it alchemy because we're definitely not using chemistry.
So is there going to be economy around the tools I use to mine? Like if I need to mine platinum, do I get like a special diamond drill or something like that?
The suit is the tool, right? Okay. Ultimately, and that's part of that optimization and that configuration, right? Like a suit that's optimized for mining might not be optimized for
race. Interesting. Okay.
Right. It might be, for instance, heavier. And yes, we will release, custom tools over time. One thing we haven't touched on here is recycling, which is that you can take a given piece of an exo, right? Let's say, I took a jetpack and I chose to recycle it, I would actually burn that NFT and I would get back with a loss the ores that were used to construct it, right? So I could get back those raw materials to some extent, enabling there to be some utility to a part that you're not using.
That's awesome. Very cool. So now, zooming out here, What chain did you decide to build on? And also, is there going to be a lot of the core game logic is going to be on chain, or is that going to be mostly off chain?
Everyone's favorite questions. So to hit on that in a couple different ways, the first part of the answer is our initial drops will be done on Ethereum. However, obviously, or for obvious reasons, gameplay will not exist on Ethereum. And we're still evaluating a series of options as far as where gameplay lives. As far as what goes on chain and what doesn't, the answer that I always give to this question is pretty constant, which is we will put as little as necessary on chain while protecting a user's ability to own and earn. Right. There's lots of things that blockchains are good for. They are not good for doing everything on chain, or particularly for high throughput transactions, in my opinion. And so we will not try to force a bunch of logic on chain that doesn't need to be. But for the matters of earning and ownership, there can be no question, and we will absolutely make sure that that stuff is properly put on chain such that users own what they own.
How are you guys approaching the, I guess, overall game design and development? Like, is there, I know you mentioned before, like initially the mining process is going to be simple and it's not going to be super involved. It's going to be more DeFi-like. And so I guess just like broadly, like how are you approaching building out this whole vision and ecosystem and like world and economy?
We're getting really good at spinning plates. No, but in all seriousness, we're approaching it as a highly iterative process, right? You can't build Rome in a day, I think is the saying. But we want to make sure that we are delivering on our promise of competitive skill-based gameplay more than anything, right? That is like core goal number one. But to do that, it means being very iterative and also recognizing that because the vision is so large and because we're building this complete economy and all of these other components, that we ultimately have to be highly iterative, right? Because otherwise we want to avoid that trap that especially like we see this in traditional gaming or traditional sports gaming, I should say, right? Where you release one version of, Madden every 12 months and it's basically the same game and, you just got a bunch of updated rosters, right? We don't want to fall into that trap. We want to be highly iterative. We want to be consistently adding not only gameplay components, but also utility to everything that we're doing such that participants in Atmos are growing with us.
That's awesome. Very cool. All right, so if you had to, let's say decade out or 5 to 10 years out, what is the grand, vision for where Atmos will be?
we have stolen a good portion of eyeballs from the traditional sports markets.
Wow, that's an awesome vision. So do you think that just going forward, a lot of people are going to be attracted to more, you know, kind of esports sports, or you know, the kind of metaverse native sports comparative to traditional sports, and why is that?
Again, I'm going to use hockey as a reference first because it's so near and dear to my heart. Hockey was unwatchable on television until HDTVs became a thing, right? As a pure data point, right? It was impossible for somebody who didn't understand the game of hockey to even come close to following a puck back when we had tube TVs and cameras were nowhere near as good. And ultimately that changed the makeup of fandom for hockey, right? Because all of a sudden you had access to more eyeballs. The sort of Cambrian explosion of NFTs, right, has created this incredible opportunity as a piece of technology where, you know, people have ownership over assets. And when I look at how Atmos will evolve and how metaverse native sports will evolve, I keep coming back to that idea of the user base is so large, it just takes something for them to that is easy to understand and easy to become a fan of to capture that interest, right? To use a slightly different example, when you watch Formula One or MotoGP race, right, they have cameras on every turn. And sometimes those cameras are on dollies, sometimes they're using drones. But in general, right, they've got cameras set up on every turn. But the thing that's made Formula One, especially in the last couple of years, really take off is this ability to switch into helmet cameras or into cockpit cameras, right, and to see what the drivers are seeing. And when you watch that, like I've talked to people that 100% watch the entire race from one driver's point of view, and they'll go back later and then they'll rewatch the race from the simulcast. And when you think about that, it's so primed in terms of that immersion for what we can do in a game engine. Just in terms of we can put a camera literally anywhere, right? And that ability to make the fan experience more compelling because they can watch from the vantage point that they want to watch from. And then from from the pilot's standpoint, right, the ability for that pilot to build their own fandom because fans are watching from their perspective is huge. And so I think that just all of the pieces are lining up properly for us to test and then prove this hypothesis.
That's awesome. All right, so zooming back out again, I want to talk about kind of Web3 gaming broadly and you know, the issues surrounding Web3 gaming, because I think that there's a lot of people that are extremely bullish. There's a lot of people that are extremely bearish, and they say, no, it'll never work because you're adding in financial value in a gameplay and you're ruining the fun and everyone's going to just, you know, extract value and mine. So like, I mean, some of those concerns are valid just because we've seen in the past, whenever there's been real money introduced to a game, it can kind of mess up the whole economy and kind of game loop. So what would you say to people that are bearish on Web3 gaming? Like what would your rebuttal be to those to those people?
So there's a couple of pieces to that problem, right? But to hit that first one, it's important as builders that we recognize A, that those are real problems, that they're not, you know, that's not going to go away just because we hand wave at them or otherwise. And that, yeah, there are people, if you put an economic loop in play and there's a way to extract value from it, like there are absolutely people that are going to do nothing but attempt to extract that value and probably to some extent succeed, right? That's sort of the nature of the beast, right? It's human nature to some extent, right? As an example, right? If you try to judge an engineer based on how many lines of code they produce, well, then you're going to get a lot of code that does really simple stuff because the metric by which you're scoring them is gameable, right? And so to the extent that there are economies, there will be people that participate in those economies for no reason other than extracting value. It doesn't mean that those people can't also add value, but there will be people that participate for no reason other. And it's important that that be separated from the competitive circle, right? And I touched on this a little bit earlier, but you can exist in any one of those loops that I talked about before in Atmos and not participate in the other. Now, that doesn't mean that the game is free to play if you want to just play competitively, but it does mean you don't have to participate in mining or fabrication, and that you'll be able to just play competitively. And as builders, it's important that we make sure that there are ways for people to play and to come on board and to experience things without having to hit all of the, not only complexity that is Web3 in its current evolution, but also that they're not getting taken for a ride by people who have perfected their ability to participate in the economic loop side, right? Ultimately, we want the people that are participating in that economic loop side to, even when they're extracting value, to be actually creating value in people, for people in those other loops, right? And obviously that's a lofty goal, but I think that that's a must have in order for us to prove out Web3 and play and earn.
So when do you think that Web3 gaming will go mainstream? If you had to kind of throw out a guess there, because traditional gamers are anti Web3 gaming.
So I think that gets into a little bit of a different problem, in my opinion. And it's a little bit harder to put a date on it, but I'll put one on it for the sake of playing the game in a second. But just to touch on that, you have two very different thought processes between, you know, a traditional gamer and a current Web3 participant. And as a gamer, right, gamers have been promised the world by game companies time and time again and are frequently let down. And so gamers tend to hate promises, right? Conversely, Web3 and crypto participants love promises. Both of these things are probably wrong to some extent, right? They're probably a little bit too far skewed in both or to both ends of a spectrum. And so the gap that has to be bridged, or the chasm that has to be bridged, is this idea that, hey, yeah, some of these Web3 projects are going to deliver actual compelling gameplay, and it's not just a promise. And part of that resistance, at least in my opinion, to Web3 is that a lot of blockchain game projects are at first a promise and then, you know, are still continuing to build and deliver things iteratively. Which is, again, it's an uncomfortable place for a traditional gamer, because gamers are used to very concrete launches, right? Here's your beta period, here's the release, and now the game is live and it has a life cycle, and eventually another game comes out. We're building things on blockchain that are meant to live for a long time, right? And that doesn't mean that we won't release additional versions, but that concept of we're not just shooting for here's a launch date, we're looking to build in perpetuity, is very, it's different, right? And again, because traditional gamers have been promised the world by game companies, they're absolutely resistant to that idea. And so really what it takes to start to sway them is for Web3 and blockchain companies to deliver, right? We have to deliver high quality gaming content, at which point we'll start to see people cross that chasm. And so to put a date on it, just for the sake of putting a date, I think right now, I think there was a VentureBeat article that said, I can't remember, it was 54% one way or the other, that either liked or hated NFTs as traditional gamers. So we'll call that, like, right now we're 50-50. I would say within 3 years, we'll see that stat as 75-25 in favor of NFTs and Web3 gaming. because what it's going to take is projects delivering compelling gameplay, and then traditional gamers realizing not only is the game fun, but there is a way to earn, and that being resistant to that is just, you know, like, it doesn't make sense.
Awesome. All right, Kevin, this has been amazing, but time for the closing questions.
Cool.
All right. What is your single favorite NFT that you own?
Am I supposed to say Cyber Brokers?
I mean,
I do love my Cyber Broker, but I think my actual favorite is a Murakami Drip clone.
Ooh, okay, wait. So tell me more about, like, why do you like the Murakami Drip clone?
I just happened to total luck of the draw on the mint, and it was one in particular that I was like, oh, that I like the way that looks, right? And that's part of the fun of art and of NFTs is when, like, you actually get to say, oh, I actually genuinely like the way that looks.
Totally. Love that. Awesome. All right. What is your most controversial thought relating to Web3?
Controversial thought. The future is multi-chain.
Controversial. Really? I feel like a lot of people believe that, no?
Fair enough. I mean, I hope so. I mean, I guess it was controversial a while ago.
Saying that, like, 2 years ago, people were like, "You're a heretic," and now I think that, like,
fair. I think that fair enough. Maybe it's an outdated answer to that question, but I'm gonna stand by it nonetheless.
I love it, love it. All right, if you could snap your fingers and instantly change or improve one thing in Web3, what would it be?
Oh, I think we should do a Thanos snap that gets rid of 50% of the scammers in the space. Because then the other 50% have to use their powers for good.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of spam, like, especially recently, for whatever reason,
of
spam and scamming, that is, it's reached levels that I'm like, what is going on? And this, we're not even in peak bull market. So I'm like, I don't even know.
Totally. Somebody tagged me in a tweet yesterday, and I thought it was spam just because they used all 140 characters. I was like, that's really long. It must be not real.
Yeah, and on top of that, like, Moonbirds, great, you know, PFP project made by Kevin Rose and some other people, but they had verified accounts that were spamming Moonbirds. I was like, how is this even possible? I've been trying to get verified forever and just no hope at all. And I'm like, how are these scam accounts getting verified? It's nuts.
I don't think this is a controversial opinion at all, but I'm somewhat rooting for Elon to win the Elon versus Twitter battle just to see how he solves.
Oh my gosh, I'd love that. I would love that. That would be amazing. Awesome. All right, last question. You kind of already answered this, but you were talking about specifically Web3 gaming. I'm going to talk about NFTs broadly. Where do you see NFTs in 3 years?
Well, two things to that. One, I think we've already talked about, we will see an uptick in adoption. But I think also when you look at 3 years out from right now, right, we're definitely going to go through another cycle, and we'll start to see a lot of projects that have come up in the last year start to either fade out or succeed in a big way, right? In the same way that Axie was, you know, a big player and beneficiary of sort of that last cycle of they were building through a bear. And ultimately, right, then their adoption was significant. And so I guess that was a gaming example, but I think it's true for NFT projects in general. And I think we're going to start to see, you know, I think people are really embracing the idea of not only, you know, creating micro communities, but also embracing that idea of latent utility. And I think people will build smarter. That doesn't mean there won't still be cash grabs and rugs and all those other things that we've come to hate about, you know, the way things have evolved, but also I think people will build smarter and build more community focused.
Love it. Kevin, thank you so much for coming on. It was awesome hearing about your background. Atmos, what you're doing and building there, it just sounds incredible. If you want to plug, you know, your socials for Atmos, your socials for yourself, or any, you know, potential upcoming NFT drops or anything like that, love to hear more about that.
Cool. So Atmos is atmos.xyz as a URL and atmosxyz on Twitter. My Twitter is at Kevin Beauregard. So my full name, if you can spell it. And Yeah, upcoming drops. We'll have some things on chain here very shortly. But our first drop will be going live within sort of the next 4 weeks. So just keep an eye out at atmos.xyz for that.
Amazing. Awesome, Kevin. Thanks so much for coming on. It was a blast.
Likewise. Thanks for having me.
Hey, everyone. Stay tuned for more episodes of the ZemaRed podcast and subscribe to the ZemaRed newsletter for more info on all things NFTs. Thanks so much for listening.